Hello and welcome to Criterion.
Close up. Haven't done that in a while.
I know. It's been a while, Aaron. It's good to talk to you. We're here for episode number 60, Criterion Close Up, and we're delving back into our French series, number 3, with Julien Duvivier. So, yeah, it's been a little while, Aaron. Nice to talk to you, man.
Likewise, man. How you doing?
Good, good. Very good, very good. We're getting into springtime. And speaking of springing, we have a couple of springy guests with us today. Mr. David Blakesley from Criterion Reflections and, of course, Criterion Cast. Welcome, David.
I'm happy to bounce in the house. Thanks for having me back on.
Yes. Thanks for bringing the spring. And Trevor Barrett from the Mooks and the Gripes and also Criterion Cast. It's nice to have you back, Trevor.
Hey, thanks. I'll try to keep my audio clear this time. It's been a while. I don't want to haunt this episode.
No,
I want to be a
time.
Part of it.
Yeah, we have the real Trevor.
The real Trevor, in the flesh, sort of.
In person. Yeah, so it's a really nice thing that's going on here. The most recent Eclipse Viewer episode came out from through Criterion Cast with the first couple of films in that series and another couple coming out, and we're smack dab in the middle. So it's really nice that we can have you guys on and really stick with Duvivier, the French 1930s films. We'll talk about him a little bit, some of his other films too. But before we delve into Duvivier, we wanted to just briefly recap what we've been doing here. We've gone really monthly for Criterion Close Up. We're doing monthly episodes where we can delve into a topic a little bit more. We'll talk about some of the other stuff that's going on at the end of the episode. But the first couple of episodes, we talked about, again, this is 1930s French cinema. We talked about silent to sound, kind of that transition from silent to sound in the 30s. We also covered Jacques Feder, Jean Vigo, and we had Scott Nye on for that episode.
Yeah, Scott was great.
So that was fun. And we also, for episode number 2, we talked about early Jean Renoir films. So we talked about some of his early stuff in the 1930s, and we will be getting back to Mr. Renoir. He's a man of large stature, so we will come back to him.
In many ways.
So, yes, yeah. So... but this is our Julien Duvivier episode where, a little bit of a forgotten director in French cinema. I mean, this is really his most well-known period in the 1930s, so we'll be delving into that some more, really supplementing what Trevor and David and Aaron, nice to hear you on there, been talking about in the Eclipse Viewer series. We'll get into him in a little bit. What we wanted to do first was going to talk about the availability of his films. He is a little forgotten with the stature of some of the other directors like René Clair and Renoir, of course. But he's someone that bears talking about. But trying to find his films is a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. Aaron, you did a little research into his stuff. So what'd you find?
Yeah, I went on a little Easter egg hunt. And by the way, we're recording on Easter weekend, so that's where that comes from. It's probably not going to be coming out on Easter. But unfortunately, he is a little more obscure and I think unfairly obscure. I think he deserves more attention, so I'm really glad that we're doing this. And again, thanks David and Trevor for joining and participating in this. But Criterion, probably the most recent American release is the Criterion Eclipse series, number 44, which was Duvivier in the 30s. And that had four films, two of which we already talked about, and we'll mention those later. And there are going to be two that we'll be talking about in really the third part of this little side series on Duvivier. So that'll come out soon. Then that, of course, is DVD only. That's the last Eclipse release. There's a Criterion DVD of Pepe Le Moko, but that's only DVD. It's came out in 2003, Spine 172, which I did rewatch again. I still have the DVD, and it definitely feels like an older Criterion DVD. It has supplements with text, with like a book inside the supplements, which is a little weird to see. It is available on there. He has a few films on Filmstruck. Of course, many from the Eclipse set and a couple from the Eclipse set. I think not all of them. But in addition to the ones that aren't on physical media, there's also Anna Karenina, which was a later 1948 film, and then Lydia from 1941, which I think you mentioned that on the last episode, David. That was one with Merle Oberon, mm-hmm. One American film.
Yes.
And then there was also a trio of Pathé releases, and these are, of course, are French. And now I think these are region free. I'm not positive, so if you buy them and it doesn't work, don't blame me. But when I watched them on my computer, it did take the disc. So sounds like or feels like it's region free. So that's La Belle Equipe and Le Fin du Jour, which we'll be talking about today. Those are both have English subtitles, and there's a third one called Voici le Tom Assassin. I think Voice of the Assassins, I don't know. And that one is also Blu-ray, but that does not have English subtitles, so you better be better at your French than I am if you want to buy that one. there are some American releases. I've seen La Fin du Jour. I'm not sure, actually, if that's American or French. You can find them on eBay, so it might be region-free. The La Fin du Jour Pathé release is out of print, I think. At least it's very expensive, and the other two are reasonable, like maybe 15 euros or so. There's also a French Blu-ray of Panique, which I believe is going to come out on Criterion. I'm not positive, but earlier this year, Rialto announced a tour of Panique, which was 1946, I think. I don't have it in front of me, but that's my memory. There's also a French Blu-ray of course, Panique. And there's also one of Incarné du Bal, which is Dance Program in English. And that's also on the Duvivier clip set. You can also find La Bandera on French. I added that to my wish list. I'm not positive if it has English subtitles, so I'm going to research that before I buy it. And then, of course, his later work, his American work, or English language, I should say, those are all pretty much readily available on DVD and a couple on Blu-ray. There's Anna Karenina. That's available on American Blu-ray. And then The Great Waltz, which was we'll probably get into that a little bit. There's also Le Fin du Jour. There's a Don Camillo set that has Ferdinand. So there's some box sets of him. And also there one of his later films, Marie October, if you're English, 1959, I believe, and that one is pretty much available. But he's made about, I think, 50-something films, and so we have maybe, I don't know, a dozen that we have access to.
I saw the number 70, maybe going back to some of his early silence or something like that. Can I add one more to the mix of titles?
Yeah,
there's an Alain Delon 5-film collection from Studio Canal, came out several years ago. It might be out of print because I think Amazon has it going for almost $79. I don't think that was even the original retail. But Duvivier's final film, Diabolically Yours, starring Alain Delon, is part of this collection. And I'm fortunate enough to own it and haven't watched it yet. I may watch it in time to maybe talk a little bit about it for our next Eclipse Viewer episode as we kind of wrap up Duvivier's career. But that is out there if you want to see the elderly Julien Duvivier directing the beautiful and classic Alain Delon. In fact, this is a 1967 film, same year that Le Samurai came out. So kind of an interesting connection there.
Yeah, the cover of the set is has Alain Delon in all his glory. So if you're a fan, you want something on your shelf, there he is. So
hopefully more. Would you guys agree that Duvivier could use some more physical releases?
Absolutely.
Well, yes. After having a chance to watch La Belle Equipe and Le Fin du Jour, absolutely. These are magnificent films.
Yeah,
hey, we're going to get into those. Yeah.
It's too bad because they're beautiful to watch, so they would do great on physical media on some nice Blu-ray releases. They've got so much of that French countryside. They've got classic performers at the peak, with mm-hmm. Jean Gabin and sure. Michel Simon, Charles Vanel. We'll get into
Harry Bauer,
some of them
of course.
Today. Yeah, Harry Bauer. you know, they need to be out there. These are treasures that deserve to be out there for anyone seeking for them.
Yeah, with the Pathé restorations, I'm not sure how the rights work, but from what somebody told me is that often if there are English subtitles on the French release, that means it's unlikely to come out in America. I haven't really tested that theory, but if there are not English subtitles, then it's possible. So hopefully.
Hmm. Yeah, it hopefully would be great to see, you know, Criterion Blu-rays, even another clip set, you know, would be great, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Filmstruck. So, yeah, let's talk about Duvivier. We're going to be talking about really his 1930s work. We'll talk a little bit about some of his later work, too. But I thought I'd jump into a little summary of Duvivier before we get into the films themselves. Some of what, and I'll mention sources a little later, but some of what I was looking at was his career resembled Jacques Feder a bit, someone that we talked about in the first episode. He's interested in the, I like this line, the tragic plights of isolated individuals. So certainly follows a certain character in many of his films, although in others there are quite a few. And also in a direct social context. So you could also consider the characters as someone trying to break out of a trap, so to speak, sort of embattled individual. So, and there is some, really during this decade of the 1930s, some folks looked to him and accused him of being a bit of a nihilist pessimist during this kind of harsh, this harsh decade of the 1930s. So
he wasn't alone.
That's right. So, and a little bit more on him. He was born in Lille. It's in the French North in France. He was educated at a Jesuit college and then off to Paris. He actually started as he was a stage actor in Paris in 1915. It's interesting, on the Pepe Lamoco disc, there's an interview, that short interview, where he says, well, he wasn't very good at acting. But then when I was, you know, checking my sources, I'm reading Republic of Images, he says that they said that he was good, but he didn't like it. So who knows what the...
Yeah,
I read somewhere he couldn't remember his lines or something like that.
He did
always
mention
a problem
that
for an actor.
His memory was not good. In that interview, he talked about how he couldn't remember his old films. Of course, I'm thinking, well, give me something, Julian.
Yeah, so, you know, he's... Here we are. You know, he moved from acting over to directing. So it's at 1918. He moved to cinema. He was became a screenwriter, assistant director to Louis Feuillade and Marcel Lebière. I'm going to try to roll my R's. I really need to see if I can match Trevor on the Eclipse Viewer. He was rolling his R's pretty nicely. So,
oh, thanks.
I'm gonna leave you to that. My R's will be R's.
Thanks, Aaron. and his first film wasn't very well received. That was 1919. So it was Hassel Dama ou le Prix du Sang. But into the 1920s, he actually made 21 silent films. So if you think about a whole decade, I mean, that's about a film or two films a year. And one of those was Lost in a Fire. One of the notable releases was, again, penned by Jules Renard, that you guys mentioned was Poids de Carrette, that he would remake. Again, that was 25, but he would remake it in the 30s, released in the Eclipse set. And that that version was actually adapted by Feder that I mentioned. And then from that point in the silence, he was invited to Film Dot, the production company by Marcel Vendel and Charles Delac. So that was the 1920s. Were there any films in the 20s that you had seen, Aaron, that you wanted to mention?
No. Did I mention that there's not a lot of available? So, I haven't seen any. In fact, I haven't found any. So, but
yeah,
I have,
same here.
From what I understand, that his 20s films were okay, but they were, I guess you could say, unremarkable. They didn't really signify the director he'd become. So I think he was probably just honing his craft, and then... Really, I think he flourished in the sound years, unlike some other directors that didn't.
Yes.
They're silent directors that didn't.
Yeah. So like you said, I mean, getting into the 1930s in sound, he really excelled at narrative clarity and dramatic construction. So going into sound, that was kind of favored by the talkies. So, but he didn't really sacrifice it at the expense of some of the, you know, the silent influence of stylistic effect and formal experiment. So he was, mm-hmm. he became noted as an important director during this time frame. And as you, you know, you discussed during the Eclipse Viewer, he also, during this time, he had La Bandera that you'd mentioned, aired in 1935, starring Jean Gabin. So we'll be talking about more of the films here. A couple other things about the overall of his overall career. His first major success was David Goldare, which was we talked about in the you talked about in the Eclipse Viewer. So it kind of makes sense to start there. His Pepe Le Moko success got him an invitation to MGM later in the 30s. So he, 1938, he did work on go to the U.S. for The Great Waltz, which was a biography of Johann Strauss. Little rolling of the R there. and then into early 1940s, 42, The Tales of Manhattan and Flesh and Fantasy. So U.S. Titles there, and that was 42 and 43. A little bit into, again, just an overview. After World War II, he did return to France, but he had some trouble really reintegrating with the scene there, because there were other established directors who remained in France. So there was that Panique, 1946, as you mentioned. That's Michel Simon, also penned by Charles Spach, which was someone that came up during, again, worked a lot with Feder. I mean, he worked all through the decades, but that we're really covering here. But, you know, with Feder, with Le Grand Jeu, Pension Mimosas, Carnival in Flanders, and also with Renoir for Le Grand Illusion, The Lower Depths. So, you know, he was certainly made his rounds with the important French directors.
Yeah, and I'd say that if there are any main writers of poetic realism, I'd say Spach and probably Jacques Prévert, who worked with Marcel Carnet. Those are the two. And yeah, Spach actually, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, so if I'm not, sorry, but he collaborated a lot with Duvivier, and Duvivier wrote as well some original screenplays and some adaptations that he would collaborate with Spach. And I don't know exactly who wrote most of it, but I think a lot of the poetic realist type of style probably comes from Spach, and of course the pessimism that Duvivier was known for and appreciated, that probably came from him as well, so...
Yeah, there was, and getting into the 40s, he did that film, Panique, was kind of seen as a return to poetic realism, but so it was panned at the time, but is now seen as one of his greats, so it would be nice to see that coming from Criterion.
It's good.
And, you know, briefly, in the 1950s, his films did turn a little darker. There's a number of titles there, a little harder to pronounce. But Jean Gabin, again, there was Under the Paris Sky, 1951. These are the English titles, 1956, Deadlier Than the Male. And we also, Fernandel was in Don Camillo, the 1951 movie. That was, he also showed up in Incarné de Baal in the 1937 mm-hmm. film from the Eclipse set. And into 1950s, 1957 was Pot Bouillé, Lovers of Paris, which was had realism and farce. And lastly, I mean, he died in 67. He was 71, just after finishing his final film, Diabolique Votre, which is Diabolically Yours, that David mentioned with Mr. Alain Delon. So... Nice symmetry there. So yeah, just, you know, overall review of his career. And we wanted to any other notes you wanted to mention about any of the films that you've seen, Aaron? Or
well, yeah, since we're talking specifically about the 30s, and I'd say that's most people would say that's his peak period, even though he did have some good work at later, like Panique. But there are a few that aren't available or that we just can't get access to that we didn't talk about, that we can't see. There's one, there's Here's Berlin, which is 32, and that had Josette Day. Of course, if you've seen Beauty and the Beast, not the Disney or the new one, but the old one, she's of course, is famous for that. There's actually Maria Chapdelaine, 1934, pastoral Quebecois. It was about trapping, farming. Actually had an early supporting role from Jean Gabin. Of course, I'm not going to say it, but if you know Gabin's career, his character genesis is actually pretty typical in that film. But of course, he wasn't very well known then, and he would work a lot with Duvivier in addition to, of course, Renoir. You mentioned La Bandera, that was 35, which was another adaptation with Spack. Actually, that one had Pierre Renoir, Jean's brother, and that was the only one the only time they worked together. And I think that one's seen as a better example of poetic realism. And then there's the Golem, which seems like kind of an outlier. One critique that he gets is that a lot of people say his films are kind of one note, you know, that pessimism you mentioned. So this one is definitely different. It's a monster movie about a golem that protects Jewish people in Prague, kind of like a deliverance from captivity sort of Jewish tale. So, and then, as you mentioned, The Great Waltz, he went to America, he didn't like it, came back, and then, of course, the occupation happened, and he left again to America, made do.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's his career, really, in a nutshell. We thought we'd talk a bit about French history during this period, again, kind of setting the stage into what he was, the period that he was working.
Yeah, and I'll try to be brief here because I think you and I are talking a lot, and David and Trevor are being silent here. Feel free to jump in, guys, if you have any comments on the politics.
Just learning. Thanks.
Okay, you're just listening, nice. Just like the rest of them. So, okay, well, 1930s France was not the best decade. Kind of ugly, kind of depressing. Literally depressing. The Depression had hit. In fact, it hit France a little later than most countries. It set in by about 1931. It did impact the film industry, and we actually haven't talked about that, but a lot of the early French films were made on really shoestring budgets. Some were filmed in other countries just because the studios were struggling, barely staying afloat, and sometimes they couldn't. Sometimes they just had to operate by the skin of their teeth, or what's that expression? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll jump in there just a little bit because, you know, the French film industry in the late 20s, early 30s really did try to get up and compete directly with Hollywood. I think Abel Gance's Napoleon was a pretty good example of trying to make a world-class epic. And then the Les Miserables films that we talked about with Mark a couple years back were really an effort to say, okay, France can make, you know, big time epic, you know, spectaculars on a scale with Cecil B. DeMille or whoever else you want to throw at him. But those films just, you know, even though they did well, they weren't the global successes that Hollywood was able to produce. And so, yeah, the French film industry did kind of have to downscale a bit. And I think yeah, that may have lent itself to some of the pessimism, like, hey, we gave it our best shot, and here's where we're at, you know. I personally love that kind of dark, somewhat cynical perspective. I think they really cornered the market on that, especially since, you know, by the time the films that we're going to be talking about, the Hollywood, the Hayes Code had settled in and had put some pretty, you know, rigorous clamps on freedom of expression. And, the French films were not bound by those same restrictions. And because of that, for films of this era, they are remarkably refreshing and really still feel very modern. I mean, there are certainly aspects of them that feel dated and of their time. But, boy, you don't see some of these things being talked with as much candor and frankness and really just an adult sensibility is what you get out of Hollywood, even though Hollywood made so many great films during the same time.
There was also socialism that had taken root in France, and that was more a response to the fascism in Germany. Of course, I think everybody knows about that. And there was this movement called the Popular Front, and this had basically united all the moderate to far left wing parties. And in 1936, they united and won a majority in the elections, and they placed Leon Blum in power. He was a socialist. So this was basically, you know, two-thirds of the political sphere was opposed to the fascist. So the party was tried to represent the workers, institute some changes. They added the 40-hour work week, paid holidays, things that we are pretty used to. But of course, there was a strong communist party presence, even if the government was not strictly communist like in Russia. But of course, they were trying to cater towards the far left and the moderate. So that was tough to manage. So they tried to control prices that didn't go well with the left-wing people. And then they tried to increase wages, which that basically pissed off the moderates and right-wing. So they had a little currency problem. It devalued, not like it was in Germany, not hyperinflation, but I think it devalued about 30%. And so Blum lost all his power. He resigned in 1937, and of course the new government formed was still liberal, but not as liberal. And then the economy grew some towards the end of the decade. A lot of that, I think, people see that as escalating tensions in Germany. So the war munitions were starting to ramp up, and that boosted the economy some. And of course, France declared war on Germany in 1939. So there was, I think if you look at French films, and as you mentioned, David, the lower budgets, I think that helped foster the creativity in these films, and also the pessimism, I think, was reflected in reality, and we see that in film. So ugly decade, but some beautiful films came from it.
Nice, excellent. Thanks, Aaron. We thought we would really delve into, start with just a brief recap of the Eclipse Viewer episode. We covered a couple of films there. I was going to just give just a very quick short take, but David, do you want to just a brief recap of the discussion there, getting into that?
Yeah, well, the two films we discussed, David Goldare and Paul de Carat, or The Redhead or Carrot Top, really represent de Vivier's transition into the sound era. One of them of an adaptation of what was a best-selling novel at the time, and David Goldare. It's kind of the story of a very rich Jewish businessman who goes through some family strife and also some financial intrigues and some some competition within the business world. And it's kind of a character study, I guess you could say. Some of the some of the torments that he goes through as he recognizes that even all his wealth cannot satisfy the needs of a human heart. We had some pretty positive things to say about really both of these films, and definitely welcome listeners to catch up with the Eclipse Viewer. Most recent episode just came out this past week, if you haven't had a chance to listen to that yet. We do get pretty deep into those films. I don't know that we're going to go quite as detailed today, since we've got a few more to cover, and this is a little bit more of an overview. But Aaron, you had said in that episode that if we like those first two, we're in for greater things, I looking back now, even with the films that we've watched in preparation for this episode, they were like apprentice works compared to the real greatness of de Vivier that's on display in these.
I was worried.
I think I even said something like, you get the impression of a director with great talent and potential, but he's still building towards his masterworks, and I think that's the trajectory that we're on here. And, it was a good discussion and a nice in-depth conversation about films that might have slipped past a lot of people's radar.
Definitely. Yeah. And, just briefly to touch on those movies, again, was glad to follow along with you and watching the Eclipse series set, watching David Goldare. It was nice to see, really for me, the return of Harry Bauer after we talked about him during the Raymond Bernard discussion and Les Miserables. Just love seeing him on screen again. And he, pops up in some of these films. One of the, I had a little help from, again, from Republic of Images, because I was thinking of Goldare and what we saw, which, you know, this is a thing we've talked about in some of the past episodes, but we see the, you know, the Soviet style montage, expressionist lighting, of course, the camera movements. I think they are subtle, but they are there, and the American style dialogue editing and some remarkable landscapes. And I think all of it very, very subtle, not in your face, for sure. And I did like, one thing I noted is, you know, during some of those remarkable landscapes, we saw a bit of the rhythm of the countryside, which I think is also obviously captured very well in the Renoir film, A Day in the Country. So that was nice to see. And I really liked the, in Goldare, I liked the kind of bookends, you know, Goldare's life, really how it started, and it's bookended at the end too, as you guys had had mentioned. So, yeah, that was great. And I did like, it seemed like you could tell this was an early silent film because there was, it seemed to capture more of the diegetic sound, I think, with like the feet on the floor shuffling during the dance there. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah,
and those passages of film where they just don't put any sound in there at all, because that was back in the day when every bit of sound was like a budget add-on. So if we can get away with 2 minutes of no sound or very minimal sound, they'll just go ahead and cut that corner. You see that in films like M and many others of like that 1929, 30, 31 era.
And La Chienne, too. That had direct sound and kind of the same situations, but I think it worked out.
Yeah. And Paul de Carot, that is the redhead, and or directly translated Carrot Top, 1932. This subjectively, I would say, maybe even compared to some of the other movies, was my favorite. I actually have a family member who had a similar situation when they were growing up, so it really just hit home for me. And, you know, of course, a coming-of-age movie like this was just easy to really tie into. I really, some of the sequences in that one where, you know, the superimposition where he's kind of talking to himself. You see kind of the angel and the devil almost there. That was just great. I would have actually loved to have seen some more shots like that in some of the other films that we had seen. I don't remember them being there. So that was nice to see. But yeah, that one really took to that one. It did seem a bit much as things kind of, well, the plot really ramped up towards the end there, as, you know, and you guys did mention how things go, and it was almost a bit heavy. But I was so invested. I think Trevor said, you know, white knuckled as things were really ramping up there at the end. So, yeah, really interesting story there. Again, Harry Bauer there as the father, and yeah, just some great great performances there. So, big fan of that one. Again, like I said, subjectively. But nice. Let's get into the films that we really wanted to talk about. We are going to go in order here. And we're getting into, you know, the Eclipse Viewer covered a couple of the earlier films, 1930, 1932, with the two films I mentioned. We're actually getting into the late 30s with some of the films that we're talking about today. So we've got La Belle Equipe, which translates to They Were Five. That one does star the aforementioned Jean Gabin, Charles Vanel. That was written by Duvivier and Charles Spack. So, yeah, I
really
just
quickly, Mark.
Yeah,
that's just
going to turn it to you anyway, Trevor.
Oh, I was just going to say, La Belle Equipe is actually the great team. If it's a literal translation, that They Were Five is just an American title that they've thrown on it, or maybe it was British. I don't know, an English title that they threw on it.
That makes sense. Yeah, that certainly
does. They're kind of synonymous. Well, I guess they both kind of work, I guess.
Yeah. So, Trevor, yeah.
If we're talking about basketball.
Or hockey.
Give us your thoughts on La Belle Equipe.
Well, so this one kind of came to me with the largest reputation of them all, including any of the ones in the Eclipse Viewer. And I had seen Pepe Le Moko quite a while ago, even before I really registered that it was Julien Duvivier. So La Belle Équipe is the one that everyone seems to say is Duvivier's masterpiece. So I started it up, and I'm watching the cast, and I'm thinking, oh, there's Jean Gabin. That sounds great. Charles Vanel. All of this this anticipation. And I got to say, it paid off. I didn't want to lead you on too far there. This is a fantastic film. I can definitely understand, you know, why people consider this his masterpiece. I may be a little bit like Mark in that the one I prefer the most could be Poil de Carat. That one just has something personal in it to me that strikes with me. But as far as just a fantastic film, you know, kind of overall, this one is phenomenal. And so I'm very anxious to hear what you guys thought, and in particular about the two endings, apparently. You know, we've been talking about Duvivier's pessimism, and I didn't get a chance to watch both endings, but apparently this one has two, one that was filmed to placate the studio and the audience that was optimistic, and one that I'm pretty sure I watched. At least I hope I watched the pessimistic one.
If it gets darker than that, wow.
If it's darker than this one, then I'd be surprised.
I don't want to spoil it, but...
We do need to avoid spoilers, because these are films that you want to discover.
I'm not going to spoil it, but one that is much darker, one that that is probably a little bit more in line with what we might expect. Not to say it's predictable, because that's something that I think all of these films have in common. I didn't really know where they could go. They could be, you know, who's going to do what, who's going to be somewhat honorable, who's maybe not going to be, what's going to be the reasons for them. And La Belle Équipe is just a great kind of teamwork picture with a great cast of people trying to work together who run into some difficulties. I didn't get into the plot at all there, but I'm not sure if I was supposed to, or if I was just supposed to kind of give you my broad strokes.
I think we can set it up. You know, it's basically, the We Were Five kind of, and the beautiful team, or the great team, with the literal translation, really is just kind of a story of brotherhood and camaraderie and bonhomie and all that great stuff. Five men from the kind of struggling working class. The opening scenes are kind of in this Parisian tenement, this really great set with this big staircase and these apartments and people all scrapping and scraping by and just
kind of takes you to Renoir's The Lower Depths.
Oh, absolutely.
Good,
right.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
And each man, each actually man and woman, everybody's just this distinctive character. You know, they just have some unique quirk about them and some little side hustle that's getting them by. And the emotions are on the sleeves everything's just, very vigorous and flamboyant, but not in an over-the-top way, but just, these are just people in the midst of life and living it with gusto. And then the amazing thing happens that a share of a lottery ticket that several of them had bought in on pays off, and they strike fortune. And all of a sudden, they have this opportunity for their dreams to come true. And, they each briefly indulge in a sort of a private fantasy of what they're going to do with all their loot, and then they kind of come up with a new idea one day while they're rowing down the River Seine on the outskirts of Paris, kind of downstream from the big city, and they come across a little house, a structure that's been kind of fire damaged, and they say, hey, we could buy this and make a guignol or something like that, a guinguette, I think is the word, a little country inn, kind of a recreational place to get away from it all and have a cup of wine and a good meal and, some fellowship and a little bit of dancing, a little bit of music, a little day in the country, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's basically the idea, is that they're just going to pool their resources, have a little slice of heaven on earth, and it is just absolutely riveting. I mean, this film really is like everything I could ever want in a 1930s French film. To me, it's like one of my favorite French films of all time. And when I say that, it's like one of my favorite films of all time because every element just completely hits it. And I'm just like, yeah, there's nothing about this movie I don't absolutely love.
That's great.
You delivered
it. Including the harsh endings and including the very jarring transitions from life is wonderful, everything's great, to all of a sudden, oh my God, what just happened? There's a few of those, you know, these stunning reversals, but they never feel excessively manipulative or heavy-handed. It is a kind of a larger portrait of how life can take us on unexpected journeys through one small twist of fate.
Yeah, they've got great rhythm. You know, I never felt like it was jarring either. It's fairly smooth, and the film breathes. Everything breathes. There's open space. There's air, and it feels quite the way life feels. You know, going along just fine one moment, and then something happens, and the perspective changes. It's great.
Yeah, it's kind of like Grand Illusion in that there's a group, and there's some camaraderie, and there's also conflict, of course. And in this one, there's also some women in the way. They're not too nice to the women, but don't want to get too in the weeds. One thing I found interesting is the lottery winnings. They won 100,000 francs, and I thought, wow, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. So I looked it up and looked up the inflation and the currency. And actually, if you just go, it equals out to about $100,000 today. So they basically got $20,000 a piece. So that's, of course, that's probably a pretty big sum for blue collar, lower class workers. But you know, they can't. It's not something they can retire on. It actually puts the plot and makes the plot easier to understand too, because they do. And I don't want to give too much away or get too into it, but they do run into obstacles with the money. So,
right.
I'm glad you liked it. Having recommended it so highly, I saw on Letterboxd that a few people didn't like it that much, and I thought, oh man, I hope this is not just me.
No,
I feel a little redeemed.
I'm completely on board with it because you're right. There's just these different elements. I mean, there's the urban and there's the rustic. There's the comedy and the tragedy. I mean, even the little song. I mean, the opening theme song you hear on the accordion, and then the Jean Gabin and a couple of his comrades kind of give a little vocal rendition, and the song kind of filters in and out. And it's just, have I like heard that song all my life? I mean, this feels like the quintessential French, you know, film song, you know, it's just that little rollicking accordion driven tune. And it's just beautiful. I've watched it three times, you know, I really, really do wish I could have the full edition, have access to the full edition and
with supplements.
The supplements and the context, the alternate endings, the nice essay, the handsome packaging. There is nothing in any of the Criterion genre noir films, that this film, I think, maybe other than lasting reputation along the lines of Rules of the Game or Grand Illusion, where those are towering masterpieces of world cinema and everybody knows them and loves them and respects them at least. This film to me is absolutely on a parallel with those. Maybe the themes aren't as grand as the Grand Illusion and the war and the Rules of the Game had all the censorship and the kind of in your face confrontation of the Nazism and all of that, but there's something so fundamental about this film, about just the pressures of relationships and of love and strife and jealousy and trying to keep it all in balance. I was really, really, really impressed and just really enjoyed the time I spent watching this film.
Hey guys, I have a leak on my roof. Do you guys mind laying on top of it and stopping it?
the best night of my life.
that's a very in joke for people who have seen La Belle Equipe. So yeah, absolutely, please seek it out, listeners that haven't seen it. I feel again redeemed It passed the Blakeslee test and the Trevor test. Did it pass the Herney test?
Absolutely. Yeah. I like this a lot. It certainly gets to the fatalism that is, 1930s French film, and well, a lot of French film, but it just something that is this whole scene, this whole friendship, this whole endeavor there, it's just too beautiful to happen is what I added in my notes. It's pretty amazing. And I did also a little symmetry. Carrot Top shows up. So we get late in the film.
Oh, Carrot Top.
Robert Lennon.
Now, don't scare our listeners away, Mark.
that would be jarring.
Not that Carrot Top. But, yeah, we see him later. And also just a use of an X-wipe that I don't know if I've seen in quite some time. I just noted that. Nice use of a, often unseen wipe. So I'm with you. It's really, really, really good. Glad we got a chance to watch it.
And actually, since I just talked about the politics, and I when I listened back to the Eclipse Viewer, I was a little one note talking about the political significance. But of all his films, I think this is the one that absolutely reflects the political realities. Others have the pessimism, but they don't really speak to the current situation. But this one, I was actually made during the Popular Front's rise to power, and so he was speaking to, I guess, the controversies that were happening during that time, and you can kind of, if you analyze it, you can kind of see that there's some things are ideal, some things are not, and there are perils with commonality. This was before the downfall of the Popular Front when this came out. So even though there's a little bit of pessimism, it wasn't really realized in society yet. So I guess in that respect, he kind of saw things coming. So anyway, getting close to spoilers.
Do you mind if I ask you a question on that?
Sure.
I read somewhere, and I don't remember where, so I don't remember with what authority this person said that. But, Duvivier himself was not a leftist. And that, while there's the politics in this film, it may have come more from SPAC, that Duvivier was more interested in the personal politics and things like just getting by in life that anybody in any time period would recognize, particularly when there's a woman involved with a group of men, and that's the stuff that struck me as well. There are things so listeners can know that even if you're not up on your French politics, this film still has a lot going for it as far as just general human concerns that we all go through, maybe not to the same degree, but they're recognizable. David's response leads me to think that maybe this is what you got out of it too, David, was think jealousies and love and trying to be compassionate. You've got the police officer who's there to enforce the law, but who seems to pity the situation as well. That everyone's kind of going through. He doesn't think they're bad people, and he just thinks, "Oh, geez, we're all supposed to be living here on this earth."
Yeah, he identifies.
But I'm supposed to still be someone who enforces the law, and that line right there was pretty powerful in a way that I think many people can relate to, even if they're not, up on French politics at the time. But my question, I guess, was, whether or not that statement was true, that Duvivier didn't seem to care for it. I'm not sure if anyone here knows or if anybody knows, but maybe I've transformed it more into my own statement that it doesn't matter. There's still an awful lot here.
I think you're right that it doesn't matter. But from what I understand of Duvivier, of course, I don't know him, and I didn't read any of his writings about politics, but I think he was relatively moderate, but he wasn't right wing. But there are other, the film industry was very, very left wing. And in fact, Prévert was basically a socialist. Renoir actually dabbled, but we actually talked about this in the early Renoir episode a little bit. So I think when you see the mid to late 30s works, it's kind of like now, you you'll see now that we're in the Trump administration, we're probably going to see some art that reflects that from people that are left wing, from people that are moderate. It just reflects modern times. So I think it's just more texture, and I agree that you don't need to know that to appreciate the film. It's if you do, I think maybe makes it a little more interesting, a little more curious. But yeah, it's just pretty much most of the French films that we talk about have some left wing drivers, but they're all relatable and identifiable on their own terms. They kind of speak to truths, as you mentioned. So
nice. Great. Well, that's La Belle Équipe, if I'm saying that correctly, from 1936. So we move on to a towering achievement in 1937, and the only physical media release from Criterion other than the Eclipse set in Pepe Le Moko. And wanted to turn it to you, Aaron, to kind of set us up.
Well, all right, David, you made a pretty bold claim in La Belle Équipe, which I agree with. I kind of agree with. I think it's an amazing film. But I think it's my turn to make a bold claim about Pepe Le Moko. Mm-hmm. This was my third time watching it, and you guys know that I love French movies. So I'm going to get a little hyperbolic here. So I wrote down some reasons why, but I actually think this may be – I'm still on the fence, but it's in the conversation. I think it's among the greatest French films of all time. And I think it's the best Jean Gabin performance, mm-hmm. and I think it's one of the great examples of pre-noir, kind of leading to film noir that in the 40s. And actually, I'd say Carnet had some examples too. And I'd also say that when we talk about poetic realism, which we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast or the series, I'd say this is almost the template for that. So is that out of line, or what do you guys think?
No, I'm right there with you. I love this movie as well. Maybe Belle Équipe earns a bit of favor because it's just such a fresh and recent discovery for me. I've loved Pepe Le Moko for a long time. And yeah, you can't beat the setting and the pathos of it all. Maybe I'll dock it a little bit just because of some of the, colonialist pretexts and assumptions, but it's just a magnificent film as well. So yeah, I'm not going to argue with about it.
Yeah, I think the colonialism, I think there is a legit complaint, but I think if you kind of have to complain about France and their culture, yeah. I think it actually does reflect French, their thoughts and ideas about the world in the 1930s. Yeah.
And before we get into it, let me just talk about an earlier film that you've already referenced, Aaron, La Bandera, which there is a YouTube version available, but it's a Spanish dub, and it's pretty fuzzy transfer, but I've actually had it rolling. And it's actually a very, even if you watch it without knowing a thing of the words that are being said, which is how I watched it, I just watched it for the visuals. And there's very interesting kind of preparation or foreshadowing, if you will, with the colonial and the apparently Algerian or at least North African setting of La Bandera. Do you know much more about the story of La Bandera and how it maybe feeds into Pepe Le Moko? Because there are definitely some of these Arabian exotic settings as well as a much more of a overtly military situation going on there. Aaron, do you have much context on La Bandera or not?
You know, that's one I haven't seen, but it's in the conversation of most people say it's one of his breakthrough early works.
Magnificent. Yeah. I mean, again, Jean Gabin in his kind of pre-breakout form is great. He's a soldier. Some other familiar faces are there. And it looks like there's some pretty good, intrigue and combat scenes. And yeah, again, I'm just dying to learn more about De Vivier in this period. But not to get us too off track. Sorry about that.
Oh, I might have to order that French disc. But yeah, I think where was I going? What'd you ask me?
Well, just basically how the La Bandera, I'm sorry, I thought you had seen it, or maybe I assumed too much, but La Bandera does have some scenes that seem to, kind of be precedent setters for, the deep immersion into the Casbah and Algeria and the French colonial presence in North Africa of the 1930s.
Yeah, what about you guys, Mark and Trevor, do you... Can you get behind this, my bold claim?
Trevor, what do you think?
Oh, I never even put it in the picture, to be honest with you, so I'm kind of processing this as you talk. I love Pepe Le Moko. I think it's definitely one of the earlier French 30s films that I watched. I'll tell you this. I'm very confused about your statement that this is like the template for poetic realism. I don't understand that term fully. I've been trying to get it. I would have said Pepe Le Moko is where Duvivier goes off track and does something that isn't poetic realism, or at least the way that I was understanding it. So perhaps you can help walk me through that. But I will say, I love the film. This is like Raiders of the Lost Ark for Harrison Ford. You know, this is Jean Gabin becoming the superstar, and even his introduction in the film, where it just starts on his hands fiddling with some jewelry, and then goes up to his very pleased face, and then he gets into a little shootout, and you know, it's fantastic, and he's a scoundrel at the same time. You love him, you might hate him too at various times. You think he's kind of a creep. So I've always kind of looked at this as more of a not conventional necessarily, but kind of a good thriller. Not really thriller. That's the wrong word. I'm not quite getting the right word here, because I guess it is unconventional. But you've got a charming anti-hero who really is a crook, but you like him. You kind of want him to do well. You know, he's got feelings. He's got he's locked up in the Casbah. Everyone thinks he's there to escape and that he's free. To him, it's its own little prison. He wants to get out, but he knows as soon as he does, he's going to be captured by the police. And so you've got this very, very dynamic story and character. I guess I'll just say, if I'm looking at the great, you know, even another Jean Gabin star-making role, I would always go with The Grand Illusion for this great, you know, pinnacle of French filmmaking, world filmmaking, and not Pepe Le Moko. Though to have to defend, you know, against you, I don't want to go too far and say that the film, I don't like it, because I love this film.
Right.
But if in your conversations, you know, one of you wants to throw out a little bit of help for me with the poetic realism, I would love it.
I can get to that, but let me first back up my claim a little bit. I agree that this, compared to a lot of the other films that are a little slower and more like pastoral, we've talked about the countryside and the beauty. This one is more urban, and it's more thrilling. It's faster paced. It's a little tighter written. And I agree. I think Pepe is a anti-hero. He's very charming. He attracts women. I forget the quote, but I think something about if he died, 3,000 widows, was that right?
Hmm. Come to his funeral, right?
Yeah, right. But then he also commanded men's loyalty too. So he just kind of exuded this power, and I think you see that, and you really see that on Gabin's performance too. In fact, I couldn't imagine anybody else playing Pepe. He's terrific.
But he would command my loyalty too. Even if someone who's not a criminal, I'd be there.
He'd make you a criminal.
And I think it's worth mentioning that this was hugely popular. Duvivier may be forgotten now, but this was a blockbuster for him back in the time, and this actually broke his career. Actually, really made Gabin a household name. Grand Illusion had already come out, but I don't know if its impact had been felt yet. But yeah, it is very tightly wound. It's kind of a cat and mouse game with the police. But there are things I like about it. I think it's just very well developed. I like that the bad guys and the good guys are together often, and they interact. You know, because you have the Casbah, and then you have the water side is the other location, and they're both for Pepe. They're both prisons. So if he's stuck in the Casbah, even though he has complete power and loyalty, and he's basically untouchable, he's also stuck because he leaves and then he goes to the real prison. But the other guys can, and I think just the writing, it was set up well. Sliman, when he comes through, and he actually kind of like the police in La Belle Equipe, he can relate, and there's a little bit of mutual respect for between the two. But there also he has a job. He has to, and he wants to capture Pepe. That's his big fish. And there's there's some characters that betray Pepe, and the audience is onto it a little bit, but Pepe actually has hints of it, but may not know exactly. And so I think there's a lot of subtle conflict, and I think it's kind of palpable. It actually kind of reminds me of the some Hitchcock suspense. So I think even though it is a very character based, and Caban is the main character. And he's the star, as he should be, but it is kind of a thrilling. It moves quickly. I'm surprised. This is the third time I watched it, and it was over like that. And I don't know if you guys have any response to that, or if you want me to go into the poetic realism.
Well, the character stud. There are a lot of vividly drawn characters, and kind of to again paraphrase Jean Renoir, everybody has their reasons, you know, everybody has their reasons to both play within the boundaries and then also to occasionally betray the friendships and break the rules and to, you know, do the double cross because that's just what they need to do to survive. And so, you know, even though there is this very exotic location setting and this kind of thrilling peek into this forbidden world of the Casbah, I think, you know, during the Depression and during these kind of the tensions of the pre-war years, you know, people could relate to the fact that they also were living lives of, you know, sometimes, you know, in intense pressures and loyalties being tested and who mm-hmm. do you trust and who do you have to finally turn on to make sure that your personal interests are being taken care of. And so, yeah, you know, this is a star-driven vehicle with Jean Gabin, but the supporting cast is outstanding, and the audience can find any number of characters that they might connect with in a more direct way than with Pepe himself.
You know, Aaron, I like the fact that you went there because, you know, you're really following up our Ozu episode when Matt Gasteyer said that Late Spring was the greatest movie of all time with talking about Pepe Le Moko.
I'm channeling that.
I like it. No, I'd have to see this film again. This was actually the first time I had seen it. I had the DVD and just hadn't seen it before. I can see where you're going. I think it really, the essay helped me a little bit. And one of the things I was thinking about was the influence on this film first was I delved into a lot of the early, a few years ago, the early gangster films. And this film is obviously, I don't want to say obviously, but I think it is influenced by the early gangster films, but in a difference sure. of them being, you know, in this case, Pepe is more of an anti-hero, whereas, you know, you can see differences with, you know, the gangster characters and some of the other films. I mean, even referenced the source novel was inspired by Hawks's Scarface, and you see a very, you know, different character there, but I think, you know, with this film, some of the things that stuck out to me were, you know, like the Casbah is a character, and mm-hmm. similarly to Casablanca, I you know, thought of even that way. I mean, you even have the start of the seas. And, of course, Casablanca came, you know, what, 5 years later in 42, I believe it is. So,
yeah, and Algiers, too, was this film was remade the next year.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, really what kind of crystallized for me, and I have to credit the essay for helping, just the template that this movie put forth. You've got the coming into the World War I fatalism. You have the criminal doom for the future of film noir. So the influence on film noir, like you said. Casually comfortable exoticism, that certainly is there. I was very taken with Inez in this film. So I kind of think of that. The it's a mature romantic tragedy. And you have, like you said, the sympathetic criminal, lover, hero, everyone is drawn to. So, yeah, I can see how this would be certainly a template and just a tentpole for this time. I think its influence is there for sure. So,
yeah, well, let me tackle Trevor's query. So
that's a tough
say, I see that. I see all that for sure. This is a film noir just a few years early.
Yeah. Actually, I'm
anxious for the next part.
I think there are arguments that there are a lot of film noirs before noir, and even though noir got a lot darker, that it was basically just an extension of a lot of these films, and of course German expressionism even earlier. But so anyway, as far as movements go, poetic realism is a difficult movement to really define, because it's really been kind of like noir. It actually came later, the labeling of these films, and it actually was just a small percentage of the actual French output, but of course a lot of the French films that have survived from the period fall into this category. But see, I see it as, if I'm going to put a definition on it, I see it as very romantic, very fatalist, very kind of existential. That's where the reality comes in. And then poetic is really with the community. Now, you could, or the characters, the humanity, and sometimes this, sometimes a tragic humanity. So I think, as far as romance goes, I think Pepe's the lure of Gabby, and you know, he's a jewel thief, and she basically has the crown jewels, mm-hmm. but she also kind of is the crown jewels, and he has to kind of choose between those. So he has a lot of temptations, and I love the scene when they, and I don't know if this is spoiler, but I think we can go a little further on this one. You guys agree?
It's available. You can watch it on Filmstruck. The DVDs, you know, cheaply and common. Yeah.
If people haven't seen it, you can fast forward a few 30 seconds. But I think the scene where they're together, I think that's definitely romantic poetry. But there's also a lot of visual poetry too, and I think we've seen that in other films, as you mentioned, Carrot Top and La Bandera, which is probably playing right now. But I think this one also has a lot of camera flourishes that support the visual poetry. For instance, a lot of times in the Casbah, the outlines of the frame are blurred. Did you guys pick up on that?
Well, yeah. Yes. There's like a sort of a tight central focus, but then kind of this haziness and mm-hmm. kind of a circular pattern. And it's like, was that intentional or what?
I think it was.
Yeah,
it adds to the effect. It adds to the mystique, I think. And as you said, Mark, the Casbah being a character, it kind of, you know, adds to that. So I love that. I also love the rear projection. And I know that rear projection was kind of an easy escape. It's almost like bad CG today, maybe in the 30s. But I think it really works here. And towards the end, when he's walking through the Casbah.
It's kind of this hallucinatory,
exactly.
kind of swirling, you know, psychological dissociation thing going on. It's not really meant to say he's walking down that road, but he's...
Exactly.
I mean, he's visualizing his new life, or what he hopes mm-hmm. to finally irrationally escape to, you know.
Yeah, and the character of the Casbah is kind of blurring into the background, and I think it's just really powerful the way that happens. And so, since we're in spoiler territory, I'd say really what the poetic realist aspect, and really the realist aspect, is the ending. It's him seeing her on the boat, them not being able to connect. You know, it's
the exquisite timing of it all.
Right.
Yeah.
How it all just boils to this peak moment. Yeah.
It's painful, and it's beautiful, it's painful, it's difficult. You get his heartbreak, you know, what he's, you know, he's going to jail, he doesn't get this girl, his jewels, what does he do? He decides to end it, so.
I mean, he's right there at the window, she's right around the corner, he can't see her, but he, like, feels her presence, but then at that very moment of connection is when he's torn away, and then the ship mm-hmm. sails on, and it's just like... Oh, it's just agonizing, but exquisite at the same time.
Yeah, their eyes never
sucks.
Meet at the end either. You know, her back is turned, yeah. and if she had just turned around, she would have seen him, you know, at the gate, and yeah, just the timing.
Just as he yells, the ship's horn blasts
yep.
and drowns it out. It's just,
yeah, it's, you know, it's tragic.
On.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's a little much, but I think it... And by the way, Gaben, he tends to die in movies. So
watch out.
Yeah. So spoiler for any movie, Gaben, not all. So I guess it's not a total spoiler. But I think this one and I've seen him die in a few films. But I really think that, you know, the look on his face, the sweat, it just worked for me. And so, maybe it's tough to place this into the template. And I could see why you might struggle with that Trevor, but because there is really no these films. While they had the same label, they were unique. You know, Duvivier had his style, Renoir had his, Carné had his. But just to me, I think I really felt the poetry and the realism there. So
yeah, it's really it's
well,
a term that's hard to qualify.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it in a lot of the other ones. I can see how they're distinct from, you know, other films being made at the time, and I guess that it's that distinction I'm failing to see here. This, you know, a lot of this, yeah, that it, I agree with you, poetic and realistic, pessimistic. Mm-hmm. But I haven't quite connected it to a distinct movement versus things that I might see even in, you know, American film at the time, you know, Stella Dallas or something like that.
Right. No, I'm not saying the story. Of course, the story is very different. But I guess as far as the tone, though, it is similar to Carné and some of Renoir's. So,
just keep watching Gaston Madeau as he does the ball and cup, Trevor.
I watched it throughout. That was fantastic. And I appreciate your, you know, the explanation, because it's a term I've always had trouble with, and I am still trying to grapple with it. So I don't want you to think that I'm saying, oh, you didn't explain it well. It isn't that. It's I'm sure it's something locked in me that I need to unlock.
Yeah, well, I've read a lot about this movement, and it's a term that does get thrown around in books and so forth, but it is tough to nail down a definition, and I've seen a lot of conflicting definitions. So I think it almost, and I hate to say it, it's kind of like you know it when you see it in a way. Yeah. So, and often when you see films from these filmmakers, and Duvivier is definitely one of the key poetic realist directors, like among the four major ones, I'd say.
It's one of those really delving into this has been helpful for me, Trevor. I feel like you. I'm still trying to qualify the term, understand it, and you know we're three episodes into French 30s film, and I feel like I'm still learning, and it really feels like it takes delving into each one of these directors and their films to really get it and what really you know qualifies as poetic realism. So getting back to a previous episode, early Renoir, one film I thought of actually in watching this was Tony. I thought of the two yeah. women for Pepe Lamoco, how he's torn between the two, you know, between Inez and Gabby. It's like the gypsy woman versus the glamour girl. And, you know, Tony was really looking to the glamour girl as Pepe does in this film. So and certainly some other, again, I won't say, but the symmetry there with with those two films. So, yeah, it's – yeah, I don't know, Aaron. Like I said, I'm going to need to see it a couple times. And I think two or three times with this film and having seen other films, I think it's just for me and understanding, you know, some help from the essay, it just helps to really place this mm-hmm. film as a maybe a pivot point similar to really what Matt was talking about with Late Spring. Maybe this is, you know, the ultimate yeah. poetic realism kind of pivot film. So.
And I think Matt, when he said that about Late Spring, and he said it's the best film, but his favorite film was Tokyo Story.
Right.
You could kind of say that with Rules of the Game, maybe, or Grand Illusion. So I think when we get through this series, which I don't know when that'll be, 5 years from now, but when we've gotten through Carné and Late Renoir, I'd like to revisit the term and see if we can nail it down a little closer. And maybe that'll help you, Trevor.
Yeah, well, poetry is hard to nail down, so maybe that's part of it. So, well, how about we transition into, you know, we have one more film we wanted to touch on. It is the last of his films in the 1930s, Le Fin du Jour, from 1939. I'm not even sure what it translates into. The End of the Day.
End of the Day.
Yeah. So in this one, again, some important stars, Victor Franson, Michel Simon, Louis Jouvert, very important film, another restoration from Pathé. And this one, actually an original story from Duvivier, kind of atypical, because he typically found his subjects in popular fiction. And this one, I'll set up a little more. It's about some aged and penniless actors. They go to, after they really are for the most part, retiring, and they're not even allowed to perform. They are living in this really old folks' home, kind of a converted old folks' home. And they, of course, they talk about their past glories, some failures, and there are some certainly some concerns between the folks in this film, just different ways that they go about life, which creates some tensions in the film for sure. So 1939, La Fin du Jour. David, I'll turn it to you first. What did you think of this film?
Well, yeah, just another really splendid example of Duvivier's ability to put together a fantastic cast. Yeah, I hadn't really picked up on the fact that this was original rather than adapted material. Perhaps it speaks a little bit of his own life in the theater. Coming up as an actor, he's been in show business, if you will, for about 20 years now, and probably has had his share of encounters with aged theatrical performers. I mean, in fact, some of the cast, the way that the opening credits kind of give you the sense that here are these beloved figures that many of the viewers of that time maybe had seen on stage in Paris at different times and places. So they're coming back for sort of one last hurrah. And there is a kind of a sentimental, retrospective feel to this film. Of people who know that their glory days are behind them, but there's still a lot of life to be lived, and this is a pretty engaging story as well. I mean I enjoyed it. Michel Simon always just seems to play old, and it's just always a great joy to discover another vintage performance of him in his prime. Of course, he's perhaps best known here as Boudou, Saved from Drowning, where he kind of plays this kind of anarchistic wild man, this tramp who's brought in to be civilized, and of course ends up, creating chaos in his wake. Here he's not quite as, out of control, but he's definitely a very pivotal character, and then Louis Jouvet is kind of the other, keynote for me. As this aging Don Juan, who considers himself this kind of lady killer, and just will not let that game go, even though he's well past his prime, and you really kind of get the creepy vibes going, because you see that he's not just vain and kind of self-centered, but he's actually very predatory and merciless as he kind of exploits whichever woman will be drawn to him for the sake of his own vanity. So yeah, to me, this is just a good, interesting story. Maybe not quite on the sublime level that I felt with La Belle Equipe, but still beautifully rendered and very worthy of my time and repeat viewing.
Yeah, Trevor, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm probably with David here. It was great to see these three kind of actors performing these old roles. None of them were particularly old. Michel Simon was in his 40s. He looks in his 70s in this movie, and not just because of like makeup and stuff. The way he's got his mouth just kind of dragging as if he's lost all ability to really control his lips and things like that. None of them were particularly old, and yet they play these roles very well and with a lot of sentiment behind them. It does. And I'm wondering how much of this is that they kind of feel like an era is gone. They all did do stage acting in their early career. I mean, they're in their 40s and 50s here, but they were old enough that as early professionals, the film wasn't a big, well, I mean, it's a big thing, but it wasn't maybe something that actors thought they could get into, and they ended up doing it. But maybe there is some of that ability to reflect then that I might not normally expect in people playing a character that's 20 or 30 years older than what they actually are. And so the performances is really where I thought this one took off. I loved the dynamic between these three men who have known each other and who have reasons to despise one another, and not even fully respect one another. I mean, sometimes the despising someone else comes because you're jealous of them, and I'm not really sure that I felt that too much here, other than maybe Marnie thought, you know, I'm the one with the talent, I just didn't get famous. So there is some jealousy to you know, others who had no talent but did get famous. But as far as, you know, the other thing, it's mostly just jealousy about, you know, personal things. You know, they've been involved in each other's lives for so long that old bitterness and old relationships come out and are still haunting them. And yet here they are kind of forced to live together to an extent because they don't have any other options. This is a private charity mm-hmm. that is set up for these kind of treasures of the world who are of, you know, French theater anyway, who can't support themselves any other way. And, you know, they could go and live with other people in other state-run retirement homes or care centers. But this is so that they can still be together and can almost still live off of the illusions of the past, which is a good or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. And they did all of that so well. I really did enjoy the film. It happened to be the first one I watched. I'd seen Pepe Le Moko before, this as we were preparing for this episode, this was the first one that I watched. So I hadn't seen A Belle Equipe yet, and you know, so I didn't really know what else Duvivier was going to be doing in this mid part of the 30s and late part of the 30s that we're talking about. And so maybe I'm not sure how that affected it, but I was very pleased. But I will say that things just got better as I moved on through the next films. So.
So yeah, so
but I'm glad we had the chance to watch it. It's hard to find, and yet it was, you know, as David said, Michel Simon, anything that he had his hands in, I would
great.
Love a chance to see it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a lot of fun.
I guess I'll jump in, Aaron, and then turn it to you to see how it compares. You know, a couple years after Pepe Le Moko, but yeah, this one it was another one where it was obviously a first time watch, and it really kind of crystallized again for me later. I had trouble with the Simone character for a while, but I think just an amazing ending. I'm not going to spoil, but just the pull away shot. And the shot of the crowd, I actually rewound it a few times. I think as far as really crystallizing poetic realism, I got a lot of the poetry here. And again, knowing that it is written by Duvivier, that I think informs that. I mean, there's some lines in here, and a lot of it comes from Simone as the character who, Cabressade, I believe it is. He has some lines like, you know, a worry, kids are a worry if you have them, a regret if you don't, which I think is just a lovely, lovely line about having kids. And later about aging, he says, you know, being old and ugly is one thing, but there's a limit. So there's a lot of just that coverage of the, you know, the aging. I think there are some influences like this almost looks like the same set as Carnival in Flanders, the Feder film. It's just a really kind of open space, really large columns and, you know, lots of space, tall ceilings. It almost looks like a castle. So just an interesting, and the, you know, the place where they eat, it's just a large, large area. So people moving through this space, very, very, very nice. And I think there's a, I'm just going to mention again on the poetic side, there is a dictation that happens for a letter. And again, it just to me is, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, there's your poetry. You know, if you're, it's, you know, if you're going to go into that kind of trying to define poetic realism, you know, it's, there's a lot of lines here you could say kind of point to that. And again, it's the last film of the 30s for him in his kind of great period. So, yeah, I was taken by this one. I don't know if more than the others, I wouldn't say. I kind of have them all on a similar plane. I think they certainly best the films in the you know, the Eclipse series that we've watched so far, even I think some of the later ones we'll mention, some great ones here I'd love to see come out. But yeah, it's kind of a, you know, even to the last shot there, kind of a nice bookend to his 30s work. But what did you think, Aaron?
Guys, this is the greatest French film. I'm kidding.
excuse me, I got to go fix my roof.
I might go out there with you. I think it's very good. This one's pretty high concept, actually, if you really think about Actors Retirement Center and like what you said, Trevor, about it really reflecting the end of theatrical or the theatrical era. And they actually do kind of rub their nose or turn their nose up against the film as a lesser art. And, of course, Duvivier would argue against that, and that this might be his statement.
Yeah.
But of course, he also worked in the theater too. That's I don't know what he's saying here. So yeah, of the three that we're talking about today, I'd say this is the one I liked the least. But that doesn't mean it's bad. It's actually quite good. I'd say even exceptional. I think the ensemble is terrific. I think we have a great villain. I guess, again, sort of an anti-hero, but although we probably don't root for him like we do Pepe. Maybe this is Pepe if he decided to be an actor and 30 years later he's still...
still trolling around, picking up the chicks.
Still thinks he's got it, but I think it was quite good. By the way, you mentioned that this was an original... Duvivier screenplay. What's interesting to me is that you're right. He didn't write all his work as original. He did like to adapt, but this La Belle Equipe and then also Dance Program, which we'll be talking about on the Eclipse Viewer, and that's one I think you guys are going to really like. He wrote those as well. This one with Charles Spack. So yeah, I think there's something to be said that his own original works were very high quality, because three of the big ones, or two of the three that we're talking about today, and one of the two talking about next week, were him. So,
yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts that, folks have? So last film we're going to talk about, we're just going to kind of talk about his later work again. Any final thoughts on, La Fin du Jour?
Just the handsomeness of the production. I mean, if you go back to the kind of, you know, still there's a certain, I don't know what is the word, but the quality, you know, the dissolves, the editing, the you know, the music, and this is just such a richly realized and finely attuned production here. So it's just, you know, the lighting. I mean, all the details are really spot on. You know, David Goldare, going back to the beginning of this era of Duvivier's filmmaking, you know, still feels like an early talkie, even though there's some very nice camera shots. This one here just feels glowing and rich and just so nicely realized, you know. And so, you know, Duvivier is absolutely in his prime. And you just think about the time and setting, 1939, the end of the day, to translate the title, the rules of the game. I mean, apocalypse and terror are just right on the horizon. And so,
pretty bleak.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of putting it in this historical context. I guess you just sort of have to put it in its place and time, and then the profundity and the significance of what's happening here just sinks in all the more. So, yeah, I think it is. It's the end of an era with this film, and Duvivier's career, as you've already kind of described, will go through some ups and downs, but this kind of, you know, hot streak that he'd been on kind of, you know, reaches its culmination probably with this film, or maybe there's one or two after. I'm not sure exactly what the schedule was, but this is pretty close to the end of that phase of not only his career, but French cinema in general. I mean, there would be a rebound, and there would be a new growth and a new chapters, but this is the end of the golden age, really, right here.
And it's really about aging too, so yeah. it's
appropriate.
Interesting is this one of the few we've talked about today and on the Eclipse Viewer. I think it's, even though it's pessimistic, it's not as dark as the others.
No, there is an uplift at the end, definitely.
Yeah. But yeah, I do see. I agree with you that Duvivier was very. I think polished might be a good word for this one. It's very a clean production, and I agree. I think he was a master at this time, and if not for that terrible war, who knows what he would have been capable of. Now, not to dismiss his later works, he did have some fine moments, and I think Panique stands up against the best of his work, with the best of his work. But yeah, I agree. This is kind of the final great one. So of the 30s.
Sure. Yeah. Any other thoughts, kind of just on the his later work, Aaron, that you wanted to mention?
He did a lot of adaptations again. We mentioned Anna Karenina, and he did Don Camillo. I think he changed his style a little bit. He wasn't, although I think he always was a little bit pessimistic. It wasn't quite as dire as these few or the ones from the 30s, especially the late 30s. But maybe that's because society changed and the war ended and things got a little better. But I think it's worth checking out. There's some that I want to see. I do want to see the Maria October, which is not out in America, and a few others. But I think pretty much as far as his late work, from what I understand, Panique is the high point, and the others are serviceable. He was a quality working director, but not quite the star. I think it had burned out a little bit, at least, and maybe that's why he was forgotten, because he did kind of. Think of like a baseball player who has a great 5 years and then 10 mediocre years. You might not think of him as such a great, but it
doesn't seem like he has the kind of bon vivant personality of a Jean Renoir, where not only does Renoir make great films, but he himself is a very colorful figure. I mean, you think about the kind of film intros that Jean Renoir did. Later on in life, where he kind of looks back and kind of gives a little spoken word intro to his films. And, of course, Criterion has featured a lot of those. And so it's made the director himself. Oh, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's made the director a personality where you're just intrigued by anything that has Jean Renoir's name on it. And, we've already said, Papel et Moko, directed by Julien Duvivier. Julien who? Whatever, But I really... to whatever degree our collective groanings can influence Criterion or some other distributor to say, hey, can we give this guy a little bit of a higher profile in region one because, or region eight, whatever it is, we really need to, see more of these films or make them more publicly or conveniently accessible, streaming, disc, whatever, disc preferable. But, these are just such rich, beautiful films that I think they're being deprived of people who'd really appreciate them because they are not region free or the import fees or whatever. Just the fact that you just can't, conveniently click an order. But they're just really, there's nothing lacking in these films that would say they're not quite worth putting out there.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, and one thing I'll add on there to David is for people who don't buy DVDs, who are just Blu-ray only, and I understand the rationale behind that. There's plenty out there, but they're not going to see a lot of these French 1930s films yet because they're not available. Pepe mm-hmm. Lamoco is not on Blu-ray. Baudou Saved from Drowning, not on Blu-ray.
Yeah, a lot of Renoir's best are not available. I think we've got The River and we've got Rules of the Game. I think that's about it, right?
You can buy a Blu-ray of The Grand Illusion, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. Studio Canal has
Canal
it.
Hell.
So at least that's there.
But those are just mountain peaks, which are great. They really become so much better once you put them in the context of everything else that was going on in French cinema, the more, pedestrian, ordinary releases, which are in themselves spectacular. So, yeah, I'm just such a big fan, and I'm just eager to hear the rest of this series as it proceeds forward, Aaron. So thanks for putting it together, Aaron and Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. It's fabulous to do this. I think what I'll do is, we still have some more Duvivier upcoming, the Eclipse Viewer series, a couple more films there. David kind of let us in. Trevor, do you want to just preview the last two films in the Eclipse Viewer, the next episode?
Oh, boy. I wasn't prepared. Oh. Just a second. I haven't watched them yet, I'll tell you that.
It'll be awesome.
Oh,
It will be great. I am convinced. What are they? Incarnate Ball and
Letette Denholm, 1933.
Letette Denholm,
which
yeah.
is earlier. Yeah.
I don't know anything about him. I think Harry Bowers in both of them. Is that right?
He's in all four of those.
He is.
But I will just say that that's kind of a very poor endorsement. But my excitement is large. I've really loved getting to know Duvivier's work, and I'll just endorse everything that David just said. There's just some phenomenal stuff going on at this time period. All of it's worthwhile, and Duvivier has been exciting. It's been refreshing. Again, his films breathe. They're like summer air. You know, they're just fantastic. And so I haven't watched the last two films yet in the set, but I'm very excited to, and I have no doubt that there will be a lot of rich things to discover and to discuss when we get there.
Hey, and I'll just throw, as I've got La Femme du Jour playing on my device over here, look for the connection with Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom, all you younger listeners out there. There is a scene that might be reminiscent of the scouts there. So
interesting. I'll have to ask you about that. Okay. I got it. Yeah. As far as the Eclipse Viewer dance program, I think I put a couple of these films on a pedestal. So I'll say that one, I really think that's going to knock it out of the park for you guys. And I think actually, Trevor, I'd be curious if to revisit your thoughts on poetic realism after you see that, because I think that one also embodies the spirit, I guess.
Okay.
And also, as far as just Duvivier and his reputation, I think he's seen as Pepe Le Moko is pretty well known. And of course, it was hugely popular. And I think it was hugely influential, not just on noir, but on a lot of classic Hollywood films, other French films, definitely on Carnet. But I think also Duvivier has been thought of as like a one-hit wonder, just because that one is the one that people remember. You know, that's if you go to IMDb or Wikipedia, that'll probably be the first one that comes up. So I think just giving more texture to his career is valuable. So hopefully, and I'm not saying that we're going to move mountains and get all these DVD companies to release his work, but I'm glad you guys agree that these are worth viewing. And I'll also say that the Pathé restorations are terrific.
They are
of,
really
of these.
Nice.
So hopefully Criterion can get a hold of them.
getting Pepe Le Moko on Blu-ray would be nice, because I really felt, there's a little bit of a difference. I mean, I like my Pepe Le Moko DVD, but just to get that extra resolution, that extra glow or richness, precision would be a real treat, and I think a lot of viewers would really, really dig that film, even if it's the only Duvivier they ever watched.
Yeah,
it's an older DVD, and it does show its age. I think, in fact, part of it, I watched the Filmstruck, and the Filmstruck looked better. It was not an HD, I could tell, but it looked cleaner than the DVD. So.
Interesting,
but I think that's just the quality of the transfer versus DVD.
Yeah. Well, that's Julien Duvivier, really kind of the middle portion here as we're talking about it and leading into the Eclipse Viewer number two. So hope everyone enjoyed listening. David, wanted to thank you and Trevor for joining us. Where can folks find you online, David? We'll start with you.
Well, I pretty much do all my stuff through Criterion Cast these days, so just find me there.
Excellent. And I, as I understand, you finished up 1968 on your Criterion Reflections writing there,
getting
into 69.
I am into 69. Watched.
Speaking of the end of a decade.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Dillinger is dead. Marco Ferrari's Dillinger is Dead is the next one up in my queue. But I have to say, that film kind of just stopped me in my tracks. I'll have to find my wits and write about it at some point, or podcast about it or whatever. But that film really moved me. So I'm a little bit of a hiatus from blogging. Happy to get back in the podcasting groove. We'll be doing the part two of the Duvivier series. And then we just have two Eclipse sets, post-war Kurosawa and late Ozu. So Trevor and I are truly in the home stretch here with the Eclipse Viewer podcast. But I've got some other plans and other ideas, and we'll be coming at you soon enough.
Very cool. Great to have you, David. And Trevor, where can folks find you?
Well, you can find me with David and the Eclipse Viewer. That's always fun. I'm kind of, it's an exciting milestone that will be finishing, but it's also kind of sad.
It is. Yeah, bittersweet.
It's been a lot of fun. But other than that, on Twitter, I am at Mooks, M-O-O-K-S-E. And I write at the Mooks and the Gripes about books and movies.
Excellent. Well, well-read, well-versed, man.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to put you guys in the podcaster's retirement center. I'm kidding. Well, there should be a Berlanga, so it's not over yet, right?
Well, yeah. well, we will play it as it comes. So, yeah, I'll believe that Berlanga when I'm holding it in my hand there.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yep. No fatalism for the Eclipse viewer. Aaron, where can folks find you?
Well, right here, even though we don't do it as much, and also on Criterion Cast. And yeah, but been grooving with Criterion now. I think we're already at 13 episodes, so having fun with that. It's a change of pace. It's a little easier for me. I like that.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of fun. Try to throw some games. You'll hear on episode 13 a pretty crazy and pretty perverse game, so don't be offended. But yeah. And that's it.
More perversity on Criteria now. I like that. It's a good tagline. So, when you can find me, I'm Mark Herney, H-U-R-N-E, at Mark Herney on Twitter, Letterboxd. You can find the show, Criterion Close-Up. Again, we're on a monthly schedule at Criterion CU on Twitter, Facebook/Criterion Close-Up, and CriterionCloseUp.com. Just wanted to briefly plug what we've got upcoming. It looks like we were going to delve into the World Cinema box set, but we put that on hold for a little bit. So we're actually going to hit our plans to hit some Jacques Demy next, and we'll be talking about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg coming in May, again with our monthly schedule. I also just wanted to thank again Republic of Images, A History of French Filmmaking from Alan Williams, with some notes. So just plugging that there. And yeah, thank everyone for joining us and listening to Criterion Close-Up. We'll talk to you soon.